You're listening to IsraelScene.com.
And you're listening to IsraelScene.com.
Listening to IsraelScene.com.
Seen through the eyes of Steve, that's myself.
And you're on.
Two characters passionate about everything that happens in Israel.
IsraelScene.com.
Today we are going to delve into a topic that is one of my favorites, and that is the view of Hebrew in classical Judaism. I gave you, and those of you who came late, make sure you have it, a paper that is academic by nature. I mean, it's very, very thorough. You have it there with all the bibliography. You're not expected to read it right now. But basically, it will give you a very comprehensive picture of the main things that I'm going to talk about today. And the main question of the day for us, for this session, is what was the role and the perception of Hebrew in classical Judaism? And when I say classical in our context, I mean in the early and later rabbinic Jewish world and the way it viewed itself, viewed the biblical texts, both Torah and the Nach, the prophets and the writings. And how did this unique perception affect the exegetical, hermeneutical, and in other words, interpretive measures by which Jews have perceived the Jewish foundational writings and reacted to them? And the argument I'm going to make throughout the next 2 hours or so is that the perception of Hebrew by classical Jews or in classical Judaism was profoundly different than that of other nations of their own languages, with one exception. Anyone wants to guess? Islam. And Islam, so well, you also took it directly from Hebrew, as did, to a certain extent, I'll also show you today, Christianity, but on a very, very different level and quite fascinating. So let us start by first of all suggesting that in classical Judaism, Hebrew has an enigmatic role. It is not wholly clear, and I'll show you, it's quite fascinating, but it is definitely not seen as a language, in as much as language is perceived as a communicative property. Hebrew is not perceived, again I want to emphasize, as a communicative property among people. It is perceived as something entirely different. Indeed, suffice us to quote three major figures from or major texts from and figures from Judaism, the first one being the Babylonian Talmud, the second one being the celebrated author and poet Chaim Nachman Bialik. I hope you heard that name. A major, major poet who lived here in the 30s, lived and died in Tel Aviv. Chaim Nachman Bialik. The Bialik House, if you haven't yet seen it, I strongly urge that you go and visit it. It's a phenomenal place to visit. Bialik is buried not far from there, in next to Pinsker Street. And the third one is a contemporary scholar by the name of Daniel C. Matt, M-A-T-T, who was fortunate enough to be approached by the Pritzker family, by the famous Pritzker family in Chicago, who told him, would you like to take a leave from your academic, from your 10-year academic life and do what you really love doing for the next 25 years? Mm-hmm. Said, yeah. And they said, here's the money, go and translate the Zohar to English. He's been working on it now for the nine years, and he just produced the fourth volume out of a projection of 16. The Talmud says about Hebrew the following thing. He who translates the Torah literally is a liar. And he who translates the Torah figuratively is a blasphemer. In other words, don't translate. Chaim Nachman Bialik says about Hebrew, to engage Torah in any other language but Hebrew is like to kiss the bride on your matrimony through the veil. And Daniel C. Matt says about Hebrew, or better yet, about the attempt to translate Hebrew, he calls it a well-intentioned betrayal. Why? Why do we find such incredibly strong views of this language? So let us start, first of all, by making a very clear distinction that already appears in the biblical narrative. In the biblical narrative, we find that Hebrew is categorically set apart from the so-called 70 leshonot nochrim, 70 languages of the Gentiles. It is set apart not only as leshon hakodesh, meaning the holy tongue, which is a term I'm sure you've heard of before, but also as lashon hakadosh, which means the tongue of the holy. In other words, Hebrew is perceived as nothing else and nothing less than what I would like to call God's vernacular, or better yet, a divinity cloaked in language. Did you follow what I just say? Can someone explain what's the difference between God speaks Hebrew and Hebrew is a divinity cloaked in language? What do you hear me saying here? I'm saying to you now, and I threw a bomb here into the room. I said Hebrew is not perceived merely as a language that God uses, if you speak a certain language and you use it, but rather it is a divinity cloaked in language. What do you understand from these words?
The language itself,
yes,
has divinity. It's not just a means of communication. There's intrinsic divinity in and holiness in the language itself.
Fantastic. Very, very well put. The word intrinsic, inherent, yeah, is a byword here. The language itself is an extension of divinity. What else? Very well put. What else? If the language itself is an extension of divinity, start thinking like philosophers, my friends. If the language itself is an extension of divinity, what would you expect that language to be able to do? You said it now. The language itself is an extension of divinity. Ah, very nice. God created the world. The language, which is a divinity, it is an attire of divinity, creates.
God looked into the Torah and created.
Okay, we'll go into the sources now. But first I want you to understand the conceptual skeleton here.
Sorry.
Okay, so we should expect at least, based on this foundation, this conceptual foundation, we should expect the Hebrew tongue to have a creative property. What else? What else does God do according to our own foundational texts? God created the world. What else did God do? Let's take the major. I'll make it easier for you. Creation, Sinai, Messiah. Here, I gave you three signposts.
We intervened in history.
Okay. Do you know The Star of Redemption by Franz Rosenzweig? Read it. It's your first task. Second, In the Star of Redemption, Franz Rosenzweig speaks, among other things, about three constitutional elements in Jewish life: creation, revelation, Reed Sinai, and
redemption.
And redemption, all of which are intrinsic to the covenantal relationship between the God of Israel and the people of Israel. Once you know that, as informed Jews, you should now expect to find the same properties appearing in the role assigned to Hebrew language. And that's exactly where I'm going to take you today. I'm going to show you how Hebrew is seen. It's a property that has a creative potency, a revelatory potency, and a redemptive potency. Did you follow what I just say? In other words, Hebrew as a divinity cloaked in language is an extension of a divine potency without which the world can neither be understood nor negotiated with. In other words, from this point of view, any attempt to figure out reality, let alone respond or correspond with it in any other language but Hebrew, is bound to fail. Because Hebrew, again, unlike any other language, is not for the purposes of communication between men. That's a completely peripheral element of it. You understand now, for example, why there are until today certain sects in Orthodox Judaism who will not speak Hebrew, only deal with Hebrew as a Lashon Kodesh. Now you understand why. It's coming from that perception that Hebrew is not a language. To study Hebrew, and I'll take that at the end of the 2 hours today, to study Torah in God's vernacular, in the language in which it was given, which is, of course, now I hope you understand, the only language with which it could have been given, obviously, because it's part and parcel of what Torah is not merely an intellectual investigation of a text. It is what I would like to call a spiritual cartography. It is an act of becoming radically engaged with God's vernacular. And my friends, let me assure you, the depth, breadth, and ingenuity of that engagement is mind-boggling. Because you can understand that once you are set from a theological standpoint, and I still hope you remember what I mean when I say theological, and by the way, just as a very brief digression, I hope you know now, for example, that once you open the Torah from beginning to end is a theological document, not philosophical at all. I hope you understand why I'm saying that. It deals from the creation of the world and the ethical backbone infused into that world. It has nothing to do with philosophy. You won't find any part in the Torah, or in the Nach for that matter, that deals with the question about God's existence. It's a given. Why did God create the world? Now it's a question that you don't know. But you understand that, right? So once there is a theological preconceived assumption, or better yet, an axiomatic vantage point that comes and says, God created the world, and He created it for a reason, and He created it in Hebrew, you obviously understand that in order to figure out how did God do it, why did God do it, and how should one unpack this blissful irritation known as the Torah, this perpetual tease, is to engage in spiritual, philological cartography of the divine language. Spiritual, philological cartography in traditional Judaism is known as Talmud Torah. to become radically engaged with God's word. Was this clear? Yes, no? Don't be shy. Good. Now let's start with a narrative. Where did this all come from? According to rabbinic tradition, and when I say rabbinic, just to put context for us, I mean the beginning of the pre-Second Temple destruction era. And if we had more time, I would have loved to give you a lecture here about that beautiful moment in history where Judaism and Christianity set apart from one another, which happened almost at a moment in history that can be identified, almost 2 decades, that brief of a moment in history, and the fascinating ramifications of that departure. But rabbinic Judaism comes as a response to the destruction of the second temple. And in early rabbinic Judaism, there is a midrash that says the following thing. It says that when the first Adam was created, Adam was created as a being of light. A being of light. Okay? And what did Adam do before God created Eve? And by the way, how do you translate Adam into English? Ech? How? No. How do you translate the word Adam to English? No. Absolutely not. That's what men would tell you. Adam, into English, is translated as Adam. The reason for it is that Adam is perceived as a bigender entity. Bigender. How do you call it in a hermaphrodite? Do you call it in English?
Hermaphrodite.
Hermaphrodite. I'm talking about a midrash here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm talking about the creation of Adam before the creation of the world. I'm talking about before the creation of the world. There is an earlier midrash that says that before God created the world, He had already conceived of 3 things: Adam, Eretz Israel, and the Torah of Israel. And he played in that. It's a midrash. Don't expect intellectual depth there. It's a midrash. It's an imaginative. It's beautiful. It's meaningful. I'm not undermining its importance, but it's a midrash. Okay? I'm taking you to that midrashic literature now that says that Adam was created as a being of light. Now you have to be sensitive. How do you say light in Hebrew? Yafe. All right.
The word light in Hebrew is written like this. Or, okay? A being of light.
And what did Adam do to amuse himself as that being of light? By the way, if Adam is a being of light, does he have any boundaries? Okay, what's the distinction?
Being of light.
Exactly. What's the distinction between Adam and God at that moment? It's quite problematic to distinguish, exactly, going back to the idea of the ultimate one. How does Adam now engage in amuse himself, or how does he pass the non-existing time?
He names the animals.
He what? No, he names the animals much, much later. He wasn't restricted, and what he does, according to Midrash, he was playing with the letters of the Torah. Playing with the letters of the Torah, and the letters of the Torah were made of, guess what? Light! He was playing with the Aleph, he was playing with the Bet, he was understanding their deeper meaning. Now we'll in a minute understand why the rabbis need those letters to have a deeper meaning. But for them, Adam was a being that was completely a being of light. Was not yet created into the world. God was waiting to infuse Adam into the world upon creating the world. But now comes the question, how did God create the world? So here's a question for you. How did God create the world in Genesis chapter 1?
By fiat.
Hmm?
By fiat.
What do you mean?
He spoke and it was.
Ah, yes, sir. So now we're introduced into the term animating speech. And God said, let there be brackets. No, not just light. Light is the first one. And God said, let there be something. And that something became. Right? Did God do something? No.
He spoke it.
Ah. The divine speech reifies the world, or realizes the world. Or in other words, the divine speech has a property of realization. God does not do anything, but speaks it to be. And God said, and there was. This idea, my friends, is infused all over Jewish texts and liturgy. Baruch ata Adonai Eloheinu Melech HaOlam in the Ma'ariv, in the Tfilat Arvit that we pray every day, the evening. Baruch ata Adonai Eloheinu Melech HaOlam Asher Bidvaro Ma'ariv Aravim. Anyone would like to translate?
With his word brings on the evening.
Exactly. Blessed are you, God, whose word brings forth the evening dusk, or whatever you want to translate into English. The Mishnah says, and he talks about Genesis chapter 1, Be'asara ma'amarot nivra ha'olam. The world was created with 10 utterances. Okay. Medieval Christians heard about this from Jews. They even agreed with them, and I'll show you why. Because it infiltrated into the Gospel according to John. It infiltrated into the book of the Hebrews. These are Christian writings. They knew that there is something profound about Judaism that receives the divine word as a realizing property. More than that, medieval Jewish mystics, were engaging in secret with the attempt to emulate the divine power by manipulating letters and through speech, bringing to life inanimate objects. You heard about the golem? That's exactly that. Christians took from Jews in the medieval period, and they came with a formula that aimed to show their ability now to enforce an animating speech. Do you know what that word was? Any guesses? You all know it. No. Abracadabra. Anybody knows what abracadabra means?
Yeah.
What does it mean? Let my speech create in Aramaic. Abra ke dabra. Let my speech create. It sounds Latin. It is completely Hebrew.
Aramaic is Hebrew.
Absolutely. It's the same Proto-Semitic language. Abra ke dabra is bara ke diber. It's the same. It's just the aleph comes, the aleph in Aramaic is the Hei Yedia in Hebrew. It
so
comes
Aramaic, does Aramaic have the same divine qualities as Hebrew?
Depends who you ask. If you ask Isaac of Ikra, who speaks about the book of the Zohar, you have it in the essay that I wrote, you'll see that he gives it even a higher in there because it came from the same language and it was the language used to write the book of the Zohar. But the reason he's saying it is because it came from the same root. So now comes a Christian magician who says, Abracadabra, doesn't even know what he's saying and definitely doesn't understand the Hebraic roots of the perception of language as a creative force. Okay? So now,
the concept of God speaking,
yeah,
as a metaphysical force, whatever, is that we're using a metaphor of speech. You're saying that God does speak. The concept, because I find it difficult to understand the concept of speaking for humanity.
Okay, let me give you an example now, and if you're still unclear, which I hope you will be, because it's not an easy topic, we'll unpack what you have to ask. Here is an example for you. What does the first verse in the Torah say?
Bereshit bara.
excellent. In the beginning, or whatever you want to understand, the word Bereshit, God created
heaven
and earth, right?
And everything in between.
Well, that the Torah doesn't say. It says, Et ha-shamayim ve-et ha-aretz. Now, if we want to translate it literally, then the beginning God created the heaven, et ha-shamayim ve-et ha-aretz. The word et in Hebrew is in some translations not even mentioned. It just says heaven and earth, shamayim ve-aretz. By the way, in some liturgical, I mean, we also say bore shamayim ve-aretz. We don't even say et. In classical Judaism, the rabbis read the word et completely differently.
Follow this maneuver.
How do you spell et?
Aleph. The first letter of the alphabet, the Hebrew alphabet? The last. If you accept the Hebrew language now as God's vernacular, as the building block of creation, the rabbis now read something completely different. In the beginning, God created earth from beginning to end, and heavens from beginning to end. From that moment on, from verse 2 onward, is already an explication of the first verse. That's why you'll find rabbinic mystics who come and say the whole Torah is encapsulated in the first verse. The rest is commentary. The rest is commentary. Now, if I want to translate this into another language, I cannot write in the beginning God created A, Z. Earth, A to Z, heaven. It will make no sense. Right? It will make absolutely no sense. Because it doesn't fall within the linguistic structure of the language. But you can do another thing. Any guesses? No. I'm talking about the linguistic structure here. We have two letters, right? That from this standpoint of Hebrew as a creative medium, now show this is everything. This is everything, right? How do you translate it into another language?
You modify the order of the letter,
which will not be loyal to the idea. My friends, it's a difficult question. Christianity did it in a very ingenious way. You don't make acronym. What was one of the names of the God according to early Christianity? In the book of John, it says in the beginning was
the Word.
The
Word.
The Word. The Word. Right? The Logos. How does Jesus call himself according to a few of the Gospels? Did you ever think about it? I am.
Friends,
the beginning and the end.
I am the beginning and the end. How does he call him? How
the
does
he
call
him?
I am the Alpha and I am the Omega. I am the first letter of the Greek. I am the last letter of the Greek.
Alpha and Omega is derived directly from this perception of the Word as a creative property. If I am the Word, I cannot be any other Word but the Word that encapsulates everything in a very tiny seed. The first letter, the last letter. Did you follow what I just said? Now, of course, the letters Alpha, Omega are not a word. But the concept now remains.
No,
not at all. I'll come back to Christianity later. What you have to understand is that because of historical, political, social reasons, first of all, it is important to understand that the early Christians were for the most part Jews. And not only Jews, but people who are very conversant with early rabbinic Judaism. That's who they were. So first we have to understand this. They were They were deeply engaged and familiar with the plethora of Jewish exegesis. This was the conceptual world from whence they came. However, for Christianity, it became imperative, because of many reasons, which I'm not going to delve into right now, but it became imperative to propagate the new gospel as far and as quickly as possible. And in order to do that, it was a decision that was made to let go of the property of the tongue, because the property of the tongue obviously restricts. You have to have people who are fluent in that tongue. And in order to make sure that you expand, they now overcame or suppressed that element in favor of the ability of speaking in tongues, which you celebrate during the Pentecost, if you right, the ability to speak in tongues and deliver the gospel in every possible language. However, they still did not want to let go of some of the major elements that perceived God's language as an imperative part of their theology. So how do you negotiate the two? You translate a few concepts, or better yet, transliterate them, but you let go of the concept of the whole language as a whole. So you will find Alpha and Omega with Et, and as I will show you later, you'll find Alpha Mu Omega as Emet, truth. That also appears. It doesn't come as truth. It comes as one of the names of Jesus. And by the way, there are still today fraternities that are known as Alpha Mu Omega. Okay? I'm not sure they know the origins of that name, but this is where it comes from. Now let's continue with our narrative. What happens according to the biblical story to Adam and Eve after they walk in the garden? It's not a trick question. They eat. What do they eat? No, they don't eat an apple. Nowhere does it say that they eat an apple. Actually, if you consult the traditional text, you have anything from pomegranate to tamar or te'ena.
The fruit of the tree of knowledge.
It's a fruit of the tree of differentiation between good and evil. That's a whole lecture unto itself, the meaning of the word da'at. Okay? And what happens in result?
Their eyes are open.
Well, their eyes are open.
They
are banished from that place or that state of mind that is known as the Garden of Eden, right? Mm-hmm. According to traditional Judaism, which now stems from the first part of the narrative, Adam being made of light, which is called in Hebrew, Or. They now come and say, V'chet hevi imo sheitchalef or be'or. Their downfall brought about the fact that their light was superseded by skin. Or, which you call, listen to the words, or with an aleph and or with an ayin. To somebody who is not very conversant or sensitive to the guttural, it sounds exactly the same. Or and or. Okay? To the rabbis, of course, it's not one and the same. The light is now clothed by... Do you remember what happens in the biblical text after they eat from the fruit? The first thing that God does, it says, Vayalbishem kutnot or, which translates into English, and God made for them garments of skin, which most people, if you look at medieval paintings, they are shown before the sin with a fig leaf, right, on the crotch. And after that, they have some sort of, they look like Neanderthals, right? They have a leather thing. The rabbis don't understand garments of leather or leather garments as those. They understand the garment of leather as this. This, the garment of leather. By the way, you all practice it. You just don't know. What do we do on Havdalah? Yes, right? When we put our hands to the light of the candle and we bless during the Havdalah, why do we do this? Why do we show our nails to the light?
I heard the Mishlash once that we were, this material was what encased
Exactly. That this material, the rabbis now perceive the nail as a frozen light from the era previous to the sin. So they don't see the nail as an extra to the flesh, but rather they see the flesh as covering the light, and this is what remains from the primordial state of you as the primordial Adam. So what do? You attach the remnants of the original light to the light of the Havdalah in order to get it in, and maybe to suck in the sanctity, which will allow you to go back to your primordial state. Or is superseded by Or, skin. Now here comes another question. What's the numeric value of Aleph, which is the first letter of the word light?
One.
What is the numeric value of the Or, which means skin, of the letter Ein?
Seven.
Bear that in mind as we now continue with our narrative.
God banished Adam and Eve. They are now clothed in skin. But God loves the human race. And he loves the Israelites.
Loves. And I think the clothing was a sign of that. The first thing he does after their eyes are open is not make clothes for them. That's the last thing he does.
First they have that, why did you do it?
Yes,
and he said, the guy and the snake.
Before he banishes them,
right.
It's a kind of like a father would dress a child when he sends him out to Gan in the morning.
Exactly. What happens here now is Adam and Eve become corporeal beings. Now here starts the drama of the covenantal relationship between God and Israel. Because now the rabbis come and say, the story I'm giving you comes from, you will never hear it, you will never find it, that the story as I say it. Once you collect all these midrashim, all of a sudden you find a narrative here. And in that narrative is a fascinating story. God loved mankind so much, and eventually loved the people of Israel so much, that he said, okay, if I banished mankind, or the humankind, out of the Garden of Eden where they were originally beings of light, I will send Torah in their footsteps. I will send the guide. I will send the map to allow them to find their way back to Eden. To reverse the mechanism of banishment.
So we say Torah Ora.
Ah. So first of all, we call Torah Ora, which means Torah of light. That's where it comes from. That's number one. But how did Torah come to Sinai? Now, I want you to imagine the Sinai as the Torah now coming in the footsteps of men and joins humanity, or the Israelites as the representatives of humanity in this case, inside the world, on earth. How does it come to them?
It's a ray of light.
It's a ray of light etched on stone, from the most amorphic, the most ethereal, to the most concrete, and then it is written as what? It is written on what?
In Sinai.
In Sinai. But then how is it written? In Rabbinic Judaism, how do you write a Torah? On? No. A parchment that is made of?
Skin.
Oh. The reason it is made of oh is in order to match the condition of the Torah to that of mankind.
Now both of them are in awe. They're both corporeal, and the Jews perceive that downgrade of Torah with, not surprisingly, a sense of awe mingled with a sense of guilt. The moment of Sinai is perceived in Jewish discourse as a moment of marriage. And I want you to understand that metaphor. It's a marriage between the bride, who is the Torah, the groom, who is the people of Israel, the shadchan, The one who governs the wedding is God. And the canopy, as it were, the chuppah, is Sinai itself. The bride now comes to meet the groom. She's sent from God to meet the groom. And she comes down as a divinity cloaked in language. And just like a bride, she's dressed. She's dressed. She's corporeal. She comes as a text. But she comes as a text that has four garments. And those four garments are known in Jewish discourse as pardes. Have you heard that term before? Mm-hmm. What does pardes mean?
Drash and
so.
Pshat meaning?
Simple, literal.
The simple, literal, in-your-face meaning. What you see is what you get in the Torah today. Drash. Originally, it should be, by the way, pardes. It's called pardes because pardes means an orchard. And you'll see why also later. But the structure itself is actually pardes, not pardes. You have pshat, then you have drash, then you have remez, then you have sod. So drash is what? What is drash? What is to lidrosh?
Explanation.
Explanation, exegesis,
interpretation
that requires what? You need to understand the structure, my friends. It's not random. You cannot be a darshan. You cannot reach that level of drisha unless you are completely fluent with the pshat. Completely fluent. Now, I want you to understand what I mean here. Don't take this lightly. Completely fluent with the pshat means you know the Torah by heart almost. It's not just that you read it. You know it. You know what the Torah says. Somebody says a quote to you, you know where it's coming from. You understand the context already. You are an erudite scholar of the pshat. Then you can do drash, because drash now means extracting new meanings from verses that on the pshat level have no connection between them. A creative manipulation of the text based on knowledge of the text. If you are an ingenious darshan, you can now go to the remez. Remez, by the way, the level of remez, which means clue, hint, is the ability to discern great depth of meaning. I don't say truth. I'm not talking about the truth here. I'm talking about the exegetical enterprise. Out of relatively few leadways. For example, what I told you about it is already on the level of remez. Because you can extract a whole world out of these two letters. Do you understand what I mean? And then, if you are a master of pshat, drash, and remez, you can deal with the sod. What is sod?
Secret.
The esoteric dimension of the bride. Now, I want you to understand this.
Is that also the mystical?
I'm sorry?
Is that also the mystical?
Oh, yeah, absolutely the mystical. Albeit the mystics, you'll understand why, have to be masters of all three previous dimensions. So you'll understand why, from a mystic's point of view, not everybody can just come and study Kabbalah. It's. And again, by the way, it's interesting enough. For example, when I teach certain elements of the Book of the Zohar, and people say Zohar, and they say to me, I hear students say, I want to study, but I'm afraid, and I hear that you can go crazy, and tell them, guys, trust me, you have nothing to worry about. You can read the Zohar from cover to cover, you won't understand a thing. You don't need to worry about going nuts if you don't understand the text. And the reason so many people today don't understand the text is because the Zohar was not written for them. It was written with the assumption that he who reads it is a master at Pshat, Drash, and Remez. The Zohar can start with a verse, give you the two first words of that verse, and continue to a completely different verse, assuming that you can already complete the first verse in your mind, so he doesn't need to spend paper on it. But if you read it and you don't know what the verse means, you're completely lost. In a minute, you're lost. It's a condensation of meaning under the assumption that you will fill in the gaps by the virtue of knowledge. That's what I want you to understand. And it is understood as a marriage, as a marriage. The Torah comes from Sinai. The groom accepts the Torah. and each generation anew. The groom is expected to engage the Torah, the bride, not only in exegetical discourse, but in exegetical intercourse. You have to eventually, through your knowledge, have the Torah stand naked before you, reach the sod level, the esoteric level, and then, through the act of exegetical lovemaking, radical engagement with the text, give birth to new insights which otherwise cannot be noted. That's mysticism. That's the level of, literally, of penetration of the text. And if you read mystical texts, you'll see they're very, very erotic. That's why Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs, you know the Song of Songs, which is a very erotic book, is one of the most popular books for mystics. Not because they are they have lost, because they really believe that it was written in such a way, because it talks about this exegetical intercourse between the bride and the groom, to become radically involved with the Word of God. And now starts the fascinating part. The world was created. Adam and Eve are banished. Mankind is enclosed in skin. Torah comes in their wake, in their footsteps, in leather. And now they ask themselves, how are we to reverse this mechanism and find our way back to God, back to Eden, by becoming radically engaged with God's vernacular, with what He left behind for us as clues? Torah is a roadmap to heaven. And now I'd like to introduce to you the term Brit Mila. What is Brit Mila? Don't be shy, it's not a trick question. Brit Mila, what is a Brit Mila? Brit Mila literally means covenant through circumcision. Brit is covenant, Mila is circumcision. An act whereupon the male infant on his eighth day, the foreskin of the penis is cut off as a symbolic act of entering into a covenantal relationship with divinity, with the God of Israel. Right? The word Mila means circumcision. It also means
Ephraim.
And the rabbis understand the term Brit Mila on both levels simultaneously. On both levels simultaneously. Two examples. Genesis 29 and Genesis 47. In both cases, we have two patriarchs, Abram and Jacob, respectively, instructing their minions, Eliezer the servant and Joseph the son, to do the following thing, in the same words, precisely the same words. Put your hand under my thigh and pledge me your oath, which I want you to hear as following. Put your hand under my Brit Mila and give me your Brit Mila. Put your hand under my circumcised area, the one of the covenant of circumcision, and give me your covenant of word, of pledge. My friends, this is something that is known in the ancient world as well. The ancient Romans, when they invited somebody to testify before court, a man, always had to take off his pants and hold his testicles in his hands as a sign of virility, which meant, by default, that he is a reliable witness. Hence, the word testicles and testify, coming both from the Latin testis, which means witness. This is my witness of virility, which allows me to be a witness and give my oath to you. The same thing here. Brit Mila is now understood as a Brit Mila. This is a profound connection that Judaism now understands the whole Torah as a Brit Mila. It's So you shouldn't be surprised finding rabbis, and I'm giving you all these quotes, and all of them are also in the text that you have. I just don't want to bog you down with the details right now. Coming and saying the following thing, which shouldn't surprise you right now. Before Torah was given, the Hebrews were giving oath to one another through Brit Milah. And what do they mean Brit Milah before the Torah was given? Brit Milah. They were putting their hands under the circumcised area and giving them the oath. So we can find a social context to it in the ancient world to begin with, but the manipulation of it in Hebrew is quite fascinating.
So Milah existed before the Torah? Circumcision.
Milah existed, of course. Abraham had a Brit Milah. You remember? Abraham is the first one to have a Brit Milah. Way before the Torah was given in Sinai. So they now come and say, though, the idea of Brit Milah was already a justification for the Brit Milah. And then when Torah was given, it replaced it. You understand? But the idea was there, according to the rabbis. Don't forget, they're doing everything in retrospect. And it's their ingenuity. But I want you to understand where they're coming from. The idea now is quite profound. The notion is that the Torah is a covenant of words with the Israelites. And to pledge yourself into that covenant means nothing less than to become completely proficient and masterful with God's language. My friend, it's much more than just knowing Hebrew. I can tell you today that 95% of the Israelis that I know will not be able to come close to the level that I'm talking about here. So it's not just merely about acquiring the skills for the language. It's acquiring the subtlety, the attentiveness to the nuances of those languages and of the language, and I'll give you some incredible examples. So now, here's a question for you. By the way, do you need a break or can we continue? Do you want a 5-minute break? No? Yes? Don't be shy. Okay, let's continue. If we find the Torah now as God's revelation through language, I want you to imagine that Torah coming down to earth. You know, what do we sing in Shul on Shabbat when the ark is open and Torah is brought out? Yeah. Key? Yeah, and then what? Etz Chaim hi lamachzikim ba, right? It is a tree of life unto those who hold fast to it, right?
That's when we return.
When you return it, I'm sorry. Etz Chaim hi lamachzikim ba, right? Letomchei Moshar. Etz Chaim means?
Tree of life.
Tree of life, fantastic. What I would like you now to imagine that tree of life, in order to understand the following concept, if this is heaven and this is earth, I want you to see the tree of life as a tree whose seed is in Eden. And whose branches and leaves are on earth. In other words, a tree planted upside down. Why is it important for me that you see this way? Because the philological expansion, the view of Hebrew, takes it exactly to the origin in heaven and brings it all the way down to earth, and let me explain. If you read the book of Psalms, chapter 119, you find the following verse, and it says, Rosh Dvarcha Emet, the chief among your words is Emet. You should be careful by now not to translate with one term a Hebrew word. The chief among your words is Emet. Psalms 119. Emet. Why do I keep bringing it here? All right, Emet.
It's in the basket.
Oh, it is?
All right. Emmet. Now, my friends, if you were able to do what we did with a shorter word than this one, just imagine what the rabbis are going to do with this one. So here's a question for you. What does emet mean? Because for the rabbis, emet is the seed of the tree of life. The chief among your words. And now remember, the word is the divinity cloaked in language. It is the seed of that expansion.
It created the world. It reveals God's will to the world through Torah. We want to go back there. For the Jew now wants to return to emet through the thicket of the shrubs, the brushes, the flowers of that expensive tree known as the universe. He wants to go back. The Torah is that ledger, is that map. How does he do it? He first of all needs to understand what emet is all about. So here's a question for you. What is emet?
What is it? You said what?
Truth. Okay, so emet is truth. That's how we translate it. And indeed, nobody will argue with you.
It first of all says that God's existence, and here's a philosophical assertion, is true. God exists. There is an ontological validity to God. Existential validity. God is.
Truth. Fantastic. What else? And now we have to look at it in the Hebrew. Aleph, Mem, Tav. What else?
Okay.
So it's a connector between the Aleph and the Tav. So
let me ask you another question. Is there any other word in Hebrew? Is there any word in Hebrew that you can write that is outside of the boundaries of the word emet?
No.
That doesn't use, that uses words that are not encompassed in the word emet itself. I want you to think now as people who look at emet as God's vernacular. It's like et, right? You have the first letter of the alphabet, you have the last letter of the alphabet, and you have, like you said, somewhere middle vicinity of the alphabet, right? Is there any Hebrew word that is used of letters that are outside the boundaries of the word emet?
No.
So what does emet mean?
Totality.
The totality of the linguistic expression of divinity. And the totality of the linguistic expression of divinity is truth. Now you understand why rabbis would say Torah is truth?
Yeah, but why, I mean, if you had said et, aleph, then you said, okay, there's nothing outside the aleph and the tav. So why not et being...
First of all, that's exactly what they said when they interpreted the word et, as I showed you in Genesis chapter 1.
So why did they have to add another word called emet?
Because emet also means truth. And it has other characters that I will show you right now. Rabbis do incredible exegetical maneuvers. But remember, I'm not after the truth. No pun intended in this case. I'm trying to understand why rabbis did what they did. Why did Jews interpret words in a certain way? And what's the conceptual skeleton which they tried to structure here? Emet is a word that has profound meaning for them. Because they are after the truth. So they now come and say, let's look at the word truth. And if the Psalms say to us the truth, the word emet, is the chief among God's words. And by the way, emet is one of God's names in the Tanakh. Why? They ask themselves why. They say, first of all, it has the same properties as et. But in the meaning, it doesn't just mean the, it means truth. And for it to be truth, you have to have the em.
So what does the em add to it?
Without the em, there is no word truth here. There's another word.
You could have said et.
What?
You could have constructed, since it's a language that is constructed to give, it represents an essence of the thing that it wants to say. So they could have said, et is truth. The fact that it says, emet is truth, whatever truth is, means that this M has got something that adds to
absolutely.
What is truth.
Now you're
so
going.
Et is not truth.
Et is not truth, but it
is
part of the truth.
Of this M? What is the
well, let's see.
Let's see. You have emet as all encompassing, right? Let's call it all encompassing. What else do you find in the word emet? What is the first letter of emet? Which means we already saw it with all. One. Okay? So here's a letter the rabbi say the unity of divinity is encapsulated into that word, which is true also for it. Unity. What else do you find in this word? Ah. God as the unified source of life, without which everything is dead, lifeless, met, no existence. You shouldn't be surprised, for example, to find Germanic manuscripts that demonstrate attempts by rabbis who tried to animate a wafer out of clay. And they said that the word you have to put on this clay piece, forehead, is the word emet. How do you kill it? Wipe off the aleph, exactly.
Is that used now in Kabbalah?
No, of course. I don't know if it's used now.
There are all kinds of words on Kabbalah, you know, all kinds of people walk around with jewelry that's supposedly Kabbalah jewelry. And they have all kinds of words on it.
Yeah, Kabbalah, I mean, Kabbalah, out of any other element in Judaism, does tremendous things with letters and words because it takes all of this even further. And you have it in the essay that I gave. You have a whole segment there about Kabbalistic thought about this issue. Most people who today use these things, I'm not convinced that they know what they're... And I'm not convinced it has any... But it's a nice artistic piece. Okay, so you have this. Without it, everything is dead. Five.
M.
Mother.
M.
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 The mother of... What does Kaf mean? Oh, last, right? The mother of everything. Emet. The last, but definitely not least. If you read the story of the creation in the Hebrew Bible, and you now see how the rabbis read it, they call Emet Chotam Habriya, the emblem of creation. Why? They come and say, in the beginning of creation, there is the verse, Bara Elohim Et. Bereshit Bara Elohim Et. Take the last letter of each one of those words, you get Aleph Mem Taf. Bara Elohim Et. Put it together, what do you get? Good. So beginning of creation, Emet. In the middle of creation, after everything is being, every element is being created, it says, Vayar Elohim Et. And God saw. Take the last letter of each one, Vayar Elohim Et, you get Emet. So they now say the process of creation is also Emet. And then they come to Vayechulu Hashamayim VeKol HaAretz, what we say on Friday night, Kiddush, right? Vayechulu Hashamayim VeKol HaAretz, Asher Bara Elohim LaAsot. You take the last letter, Emet. So they now come and say, Emet is the seal, is the creation, the process and seal of creation. The beginning, process, and seal of creation. Chotamo shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Exactly. The seal of creation, the seal of God. Which now comes and takes the word emet to a completely different level. It has nothing to do with merely truth. Emet is now what? Don't be shy. No, it has nothing to do with faith for them.
So what was your question?
What is emet for the rabbis now that they look at it from this angle?
God.
It is totality. But it is the totality of
God.
Of God through the word of the... Ah, okay, now you're talking like Jews. From that... Not just the... It is the totality of God as manifest in the word of the Torah. Now, if the seed of the tree is true, what about the tree? Okay, let me ask you a different question.
What is the relationship between a tree and its seed? Exactly. Potentiality versus actuality. Once the tree is out there, the seed no longer exists. And it will be created again in its own seed. But the tree is the realization of a potential that had already existed in the seed. In other words, the tree is a realized potential. Everything that the tree is already exists in the seed in potential. All of creation
is potentially true if you find the right way to discern it. In other words, the difference for the rabbis that look at this from this vantage point between this abstract truth of heaven and reality is not that you live in a lie. Is that you live in confusion.
That you lose what I told you last week. That you lose the conceptual forest for terminological trees. You have to stay focused. And if you find the way to work Torah, to work through Torah,
you can work through the thicket and eventually find your way from the many to the few, to the few, to the few, and eventually bask in
the light of truth, absolute truth. And I'm going to give you an example. Where were the Jewish people, as a nation? They were not called Jews yet, they were called Hebrews. Where were they forged as a nation?
Egypt.
Hmm?
In Egypt.
In Egypt and? In the desert. Great. What are the most obvious properties of a desert? Sand, yeah, it's arid, right? It's dry. What else?
Barren.
What else?
No water.
No? Well, there is water. It's just very hard to find. I mean, there's a difference, right? What else?
No boundaries.
No boundaries. No boundary? What do you mean by that? That's interesting. You mean that it's constantly changing, it's constantly evolving? That's what you mean? What do you mean exactly, no boundaries? Because we do have boundaries to deserts in the world, as far as I know. Okay. So there is some sort of fluctuation there. Okay, what else? Hostile.
Austere.
Okay, what else? Well, there are things to grow, but again, maybe like water, they're hard to find sometimes. Well, when we think about desert, everything that you said makes sense. I mean, we think about an arid land, we think about a land that is not full of water, things that it could be austere, hostile, it could be dangerous. It could be barren, silent, right? All of these things come to mind. Think about a nation that is being forged in such a landscape. And think about a nation that is being forged in such a landscape, surrounded by what it believes is the complete intellectual, spiritual, religious, theological ignorance of the nations around it. Let me even make it easier for you. Think about what it means to be forged in a desert, believing that you are surrounded by people whose spiritual, religious, theological lives are as barren as the desert from whence you came. What will be the most desirable commodity in such a world? You already said it. What will be the most desirable commodity in a desert?
Water.
What will be the most desirable commodity in the intellectual?
Knowledge.
Enlightenment. Right? Now for the rabbis who read Torah, they come and say, guys, you don't have to be a genius Because you already see it in the language of Torah that there is a symbiosis, a correlation between words that refer to desert and water and words that refer to wisdom and knowledge. They all stem from the same, which is what in Hebrew? How do you call the Dalet Betresh? What is it? Lolo. Shoresh. The shoresh of a word. Did you ever think about why it's called shoresh? What does a shoresh mean?
Root. It's not coincidental that now the very beginning of the words that stem from that truth are the roots of that tree of life.
Just as it is not coincidental, my friends, that the covenantal pledge that you create with that tree, God calls it Ot Hi Le'olam. When we say the Shema, we say Ve'hayu Le Ot Al Yadecha U'Letotafot Ben Enecha. What does the word Ot mean?
Sign.
Sign? No, what does it mean in Hebrew also? Letter.
Do you understand why
the word letter is understood as a sign from God as part of the Brit Milah? As the covenant of the word is made of letters, of signs, of symbolic acts, of commitment. So now we look for the roots. The Hebrew man or woman here are now looking for roots to try and understand the intrinsic relationship between water in the physical landscape and knowledge in the mental, spiritual, and intellectual landscapes. And they find the same words. In other words, they find Torah corresponding simultaneously with two realms through language. One is the physical realm, the actual landscape which the Israelites traverse and its myriad of challenges, we'll see in a minute. And at the same time, they now say, do not read Yetziat Mitzrayim as merely an exodus from a landscape, somewhere with boundaries and borders. Read it as Yetziat Min HaMitzrayim. Read it as an exodus from one owns myopic standpoint, one owns a narrow-minded vision of life. In other words, an expansion of self through intellectual inquiry. And I'll show you how it's seen in the language itself. Yeah. Water is the rarest commodity and the most necessary one.
And are we linking that with the fact that knowledge is hidden, like water is hidden in a desert, that knowledge is hidden in a desert?
But in the same way, spiritually, when they were walking through the desert, surrounded by the people who were ignorant,
exactly,
intellectuals, etc., what was the greatest commodity?
I have it in the paper. Look, you come now and you say, in the desert, the most precious commodity without which life cannot sustain itself is this. By nature, by the inner logic of desert life, it is rare and it is precious. Right? Now, this is the physical level. On the mental level, the Israelites are like the tiny bit of water in a world of ignorance and paganism, which is the desert.
Mm-hmm.
So the quality...
Hmm? But they were pagans too. Until they accepted the Torah.
They were idol worshippers, yes. But again, I'm not talking about truth here. I'm talking about the evolution of the way they perceive Hebrew. So remember, guys, I'm not seeking the truth. I'm seeking the way they saw the truth. And what I can learn about the evolution of Judaism from it. We have to make this distinction. Okay? So the physical property of water in a desert
which is the landscape wherein the Israelites historically had evolved, is now matched with the mental property of knowledge, the intellectual scrutiny. And I'll show you how now, in the Torah, and the rabbis have a field day with that one, because for them that's the ultimate proof that God's, that Hebrew is God's vernacular, the same roots associate with the physical property of water as they associate with the mental property of knowledge. Many of those words, by the way, you already know. You just never necessarily made a connection. So first of all, it is not a coincidence that the desert, which in Hebrew is Midbar, is the language where the divine word is revealed to the Israelites, for the rabbis. The Midbar Medaber. This is the place where in the Midbar the word comes to life. Now, it is not a coincidence that the word Davar in Hebrew means both thing, a tangible thing, and speech, dibur. Right? Alright. So you have now the Midbar, which is a place that speaks and gives tangibility to the abstract. It is the actual place where you get meaning. Now let's start with, let's see what we find in the Midbar, physically. Where did Abraham go after Sarah dies? Yes? Parashat Chayei Sarai went to Be'er Sheva. How do you translate Be'er Sheva? Seven wells. So what is a Be'er? Well, a water well, right? Be'er. The word Be'er means water well in the desert. Water well, it can be also not in the desert, but in Abraham's case, it's a desert, right? Why do you build a well? Guys, it's not a trick question, isn't it? To extract water that is in the depth of the depth of the earth, yeah, right? How do you say in Hebrew to expound or to understand the deeper meaning of a text? How? Leva'er. It's the same root. Be'er is the same root for a well and for expounding or extracting meaning, which is, by the way, a Platonic view of knowledge. Plato view knowledge, right, as an intrinsic element that exists within the human and did not believe in external knowledge. For Plato, the human doesn't learn but rather rejoins his human condition through memory. That's where the term comes, to remember, to become a member of a human race again, by realizing knowledge that you already have. This is exactly the same idea. You delve deep in order to extract the meaning of the word of God. It's like delving deep into the arid landscape of the desert in order to extract the water. Okay? What is the name of the rock upon which the temple of Israel was built in Jerusalem? The rock. There is a rock, right? Dome of the Rock today surrounds, obviously by its name, it surrounds a rock. What was the name of that rock in Jerusalem? Eben Ha-Shtia. The rock of foundation. What does the word shata, the root shata, mean? It means both foundation and it means to drink water. That's why the rabbis now come and say it is from that rock that the foundation of the entire world came forth as four rivers that went in each direction. Why do they say four rivers? Where do they take that one from? Genesis chapter 1, the depiction of the Garden of Eden. Ve'yusham le'arba'a rashim. So they separate into four heads. So shtiyah is both foundation and a drink. How do you say river in Hebrew? Now you're in the desert, you come across a big river. Wow, fantastic. How? Nahar. Don't be shy, guys. Nun, hey, resh is the root. The root of the tree of life is Nahar. How do you say when something is intellectually lucid, clear?
Nahil.
Nahil. Nahil, same root, now comes and says, wow, I get it. It flows against my eyes like a river. I get it intellectually. How do you say a water spring, a spring of water, or a water fountain?
Ma'ayan.
Ma'ayan. Right? How do you say to scrutinize a text? Le'ayen. Same root. Ayin. And here we have midbar, which comes from davar. Okay?
So why don't we have any, like, baptism or any...
Why don't we have?
Why don't we have any baptism or any, like, ritual? I guess we...
Okay, first of all, we do. It's called a mikveh. And it's a form of baptism. I just don't want to use those words because people take words out of context. But it is. And I'll show you much more than that. And if you read the essay, I'll give many, many examples all the way to the Dead Sea Scrolls. The reference of water and wisdom and water and wisdom and water and wisdom. By the way, all you have to do is read Mishlei, where it says quite simply, that goes to what you said, Maim amukim etza belev ish ve'ish tvuna itlena, which translate, the wisdom of man is like deep waters that are instilled in the depths of the earth. And a man of discernment will aim to draw them out. End of story. You get the parallel right there. But I want you to understand where it comes from. And I want you to see how the people, how rabbis, saw it already manifesting in the language. It's not that they needed to make the connection. For them, it was there. All they had to do is figure it out. To remove the branches and start seeing the stem. And go to the roots and say, wow, this root goes boom, boom. This root goes boom, boom. This root goes boom, boom. I'm making the connection. There are two parallel worlds here. A physical world and a mental world. And they use the root to combine them. God's vernacular. Languages don't usually do that.
They didn't use the words then. God, I mean, they extracted the structure.
They believe it's all belief.
Right.
But they found it here in an ingenious way, which of course perpetuated this belief even further.
Some people would say that they created this structure. There's a big difference between saying that the very enlightened human being, group of human beings, actually created a language that reflected concepts that men decided had to correlate to each other.
Which is a very valid claim.
No.
If I'm looking now at language, if I gave you a lecture about the historical, linguistic evolution of Hebrew, I would go this way.
Right.
I would say, guys, look, it is truly ingenious. And look how they built it. And now let's understand it in the context of building a language out of the desert. And what does that mean?
The question is, like, is it really? When somebody argues that, when somebody, I just want to ask you, somebody wants to argue, is it really conceivable? Is it conceivable that the human mind could create a structure?
Of course. Of course it is conceivable. It is brilliant, but it's conceivable. Yeah? But I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the way it is perceived in classical Judaism. I absolutely see this as an option. I still can tell you that for me, as a Jew and as a scholar of Judaism, this is mind-boggling. I mean, the depth and the complexity is really mind-boggling. What do I believe?
Yes. I'm curious if somebody says you're very knowledgeable and very erudite, so you've looked at this, at the structure of the language. Is it conceivable?
Okay, I'll do something that I usually don't do. I'll do something I usually don't do. I usually don't let my personal beliefs interfere.
Sorry,
but I will tell you that I maintain that the Hebrew language is one of the most profound examples of human ingenuity. And I have no full explanation to it. Let's stop there. I have no full explanation to it from a linguistic standpoint. But I'm not a linguist. I'm not a scholar of linguistics. Let's continue, guys. We had Be'er, we had Nahar, we had Ayin, we had Davar, we had Ma'ayan, right? Ayin. How do you say to squeeze or to set apart liquid from a sponge?
Lischot, that's one word. There is another word.
Limtzot
is more to suck out. I'm going to squeeze. Lehafrish. Lehafrish, my... Extract the water by squeezing it. Lehafrish. When you're there, you take it like this, and you come to separate it, right? Lehafrish. How do you call... Wait. How do you call the point of a mountain where water goes in one direction and another direction?
Watershed.
The watershed. How do you call watershed in Hebrew? Parashat Mayim. Parashat Mayim. How do you call the parts in the Torah where one wisdom goes in one direction, stops, and now starts another wisdom in another direction? Parashah. How do you call now squeezing the deeper meaning of the words out of Torah by studying? Perush.
So the root Pereshim is another one, right?
It's another one.
And it's no accident that the rabbis were Pereshim.
How do you say a brook in Hebrew? That's a hard one. Brook. Brook. You know what's a brook in English? Oh, a brook is like a tiny stream. Brook. You can say Yuval, or you can say Peleg. 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 When you have two rabbis arguing over words of Torah and they disagree, they are plukta. Each one is his own stream of water. Now, plukta. Plukta in Hebrew, in Aramaic, and in Hebrew means an argument. Over Torah, not just in Torah. Today we use it also bar plukta on many things. But the concept in the rabbinic Judaism is plukta over words of Torah. The Rabbi Yosei, plukta over Rabbi Yochanan. Plukta, pele. This one goes this way with the water, this one goes this way with the water.
You realize you also have
to be flaga. Now, right? Yeah. Flaga, pluga in the army, and all. Yeah.
The letters of a word. You have different meanings, and it's all compiled for us. Why is it so available among rabbis to mean? You're saying that you take a word, and each one stretches out, mm-hmm. and that's how they compile information. They interpret the words for us.
Right.
Why is it so available among rabbis?
Okay, good question. And here you have to understand again the notion of Torah is God's vernacular, or it's a divinity cloaked in language. I don't know if you were in the room when I talked about this at the beginning, because I think you came late. So when I talked about the Torah being seen as God's vernacular, it is important to understand that from a classical rabbinic standpoint, Torah is not a text. That's why the Babylonian Talmud says, "En mukdam u'meuchar b'Torah." There is neither early nor late in the Torah. You can read it at any point, and then venture to any chapter and start interpreting. Nope, it's not a free game. You have to be a master. You have to be a master of Padres or Pardes to be able to do it. But you can do it because the Torah now is a divinity cloaked in language. In other words, every word is potentially associated with another word. And what I'm giving you now is only one way of understanding, and probably there are other hidden layers which I haven't yet figured out. That's what a rabbi will tell me. So, with all due respect to you, you just stumbled on the beginning of the roots here. There is much more. And I'm not even talking about mystics who deal now already now with what I call philological atomism. They break letters already into their iotas. They come and say, for example, I'll give you an example since you asked. There's a midrash that asks, why does the Torah begin with the letter bet instead of the letter aleph? There's a whole midrash on it. It makes sense that we'll start with Aleph. It is the first letter. It signifies God's unity, blah, blah, blah. We just talked about all of this. So there's a Midrash. It's called Midrash Tanchuma on Genesis 2:1. And it says, the letter Aleph came to HaKadosh Baruch Hu crying and said, "You have debased me. You have... I should have..." And God says, "Look, I've chosen that word because its structure points to its meaning." He says, "How so?" He says, "I created a letter. I created a letter which is open only in one direction in order to remind the reader right from the get-go, don't ask any question about the moment before."
It is beyond your mind to understand, it be beyond you to comprehend. Aleph allows going in all directions, I cannot use you for that purpose. So for mystics, the shape of the letter is also part of God's vernacular. In the Midrash, of course, it's more playful in that sense, and God says to Aleph, I hear you, and I promise I'm going to use you as the first letter of the Ten Commandments. And indeed, the first letter of the Ten Commandments is Anochi Adonai Elohecha, is the Aleph. So the Midrash says it was God's reward to the Aleph for being patient about not being the first one.
In Genesis chapter 1.
Okay? So there are myriads and myriads of meaning. I'm only showing you now one example of how to treat that. Let's continue. What does the word Geut mean?
Right.
Ah?
Right.
Lolo, Geut.
Like Geut
the shepherd? Ken, what does it mean, Geut?
High tide.
High tide of?
Water.
High tide, right? Are you familiar with the name Seadia?
Gaon.
Yeah. The word Gaon, which translates in modern Hebrew to genius, comes from the rabbinic title of the head of the yeshiva in Sura and Pompadita in Iraq, in Babylonia. And he was called Gaon exactly for that reason. The water of knowledge rising in his brain to such a level that he's in a state of Geut all the time. Gimel Aleph Hey, another root. Did somebody say Jesus? I'm sorry? Lo, Geula is Gimel Aleph Lamed. The root is completely different. It's redemption. Gaal is a completely different story. Okay? So now, guys, I want you to listen to an argument or a plukta between two rabbis in the Mishnah that they discuss now their own students. And one of them says the following thing. And now I want you to hear it with all this context. Because trust me, this entire context was very much part of the conceptual world of the rabbis who composed the Mishnah. So one rabbi comes and says, have you seen my student, Yochanan Horkanus, who is like a water cistern that does not lose one drop of water? So the other rabbi says, I acknowledge, but my student is like an ever-growing fountain. Yours accepts knowledge and retains it. My produces knowledge of his own. Therefore, mine is superior. But listen to the language. It's all around water. It's all from that conceptual mindset that comes and says, water equals knowledge. And in the Torah, you see it through the roots. So now what happens is that rabbinic Judaism cultivates an entire culture whose most radical manifestations are in Jewish mysticism that now comes and says the following thing. If you want to reverse the mechanism which had brought about your demise vis-a-vis banishment from Eden, you have to use the tool, the only tool that was given to you to do so. And that is?
Hebrew.
Not just Hebrew. Torah in Hebrew. Torah in Hebrew. Why? Because Hebrew is a mechanism whose uncoding allows you to enter into the inner life of God. Now, if we had time, I would have shared with you a fantastic excerpt from the early rabbinic world, known as the four who had entered the Pardes. Now, first of all, anybody who doesn't know it, raise your hand. Okay. The four who had entered the Pardes, first of all, now that you hear Pardes, you already hear a language that uses trees. So you immediately should be, there's something here. Pardes is the trees. Pardes is the trees of knowledge and life that came from heaven, right? The roots of which are in heaven. My goal is to reach that point, hence the Christian term, paradise.
Okay? The paradise in Christianity is pardes. It's literally that act. It just does, it, you don't get to paradise through what Jews do. You get through acts of loving kind and other. For Jews, getting to paradise, there was only one way of doing it. Through climbing the ladder, the linguistic ladder, the philological ladder, the intellectual engagement with God's vernacular. Because that was the only trail left back. By the way, you have to understand the mitzvot in order to accept them.
Why?
Otherwise you can't accept them.
But you don't have to. It's
But what nase? Yeah. There are so many mitzvot whose meaning is multi-layered. I'll give you an example. One of the reasons, first of all, one of the reasons the rabbis, that's a whole, I'll talk about it when I talk about the class that I have from Biblical to Rabbinic Judaism, the transition of authority. We'll talk about that as well. But I'll give you an example. The rabbis come and say that a literal meaning of the mitzvot, or some of the commands, not commandments, in the Bible, if you understand it literally, it brings you literally to the verge of a paradox. So you can't understand them literally. You have to work a midrashic and legal manipulation in order to figure out the real essence of what you're supposed to do. Example is the rule of Ein tachat ein, shen tachat shen. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. The rabbis of the 9th, 8th, 9th, 10th centuries, had, including Saadia Gaon, who spearheaded that argument, argued vehemently with the Karaites, who were very prosperous at the time, who believed in a literal understanding of the Torah. Until today, by the way, there is a large Karaite community in Ashdod, in Ashkelon. For them, what it says, no Mishnah, no Talmud, nothing. Evangelic Jews, so to speak. The rabbis come and say, the Torah says, if somebody came and injured somebody's eye or took it out, you should, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, da da da. So the rabbis now says, okay, a question. If you look at the eye, it has two properties at least. One of them is functional, you see. The other one is aesthetic, is aesthetics. It's nice. One can have two eyes that are both. In other words, they're both working, like all of us, thank God. And they're shaped well. They're okay. Other people can have an eye that doesn't function. He's blind, but it's still intact. So it has its aesthetic, its beauty is intact. Another guy can have a very deformed eye, but functioning. Now what happens, they ask, in the Babylonian Talmud, if a blind man took out the eye of a seeing man, how can the seeing man punish him according to the violation? What happens if somebody who has only one eye took one eye from a guy who has two eyes? Is he, by virtue of having one eye already punished? It's absurd. So they say the literal understanding is completely out and you need to understand it differently. I'll give you another example. The separation of milk, dairy and meat. Where does it come from originally? Al tevashel gdi, you should not cook a calf in its mother's milk. Guys, it has nothing to do with the separation of meat and milk. Nothing. The statement itself says absolutely nothing about not cooking milk and actually, if you look at the story of Abraham with the three angels, he cooks a lamb in butter. Read the Torah. So what are we talking about? Here's a thought. Perhaps there is another layer here. That is a moral issue. You cannot take a property like a mother's milk that aims to give life to the calf and use it exactly against its own purpose. Now, what are the moral ramifications of that? They're profound. They have nothing to do with dietary laws, but they are morally profound. There's another layer. I'm not saying that not separating is, I'm not arguing now with the classical rabbinic dictum. All I'm saying is there are many, many ways by which to understand Torah, and the preconceived assumption that some clues to how to understand Torah are hiding in the linguistic structure are unique to the Torah. This is why, by the way, in Islam, who borrowed heavily from Judaism, I don't know how much you're conversant with Muslim theology, but for example, Islam is the Quran is divided into two periods. There is the Mecca period, and there is the Al-Madinah period. The Mecca period is the period before Muhammad starts the Hijrah, the immigration to Medina after he was kicked out by his uncle from Mecca. It constitutes also the beginning of the Muslim calendar. It happened in the year 622 CE. The Mecca Quran commands the devout Muslim to pray three times a day facing Jerusalem. The Medina commands the devout Muslim to pray five times a day facing Mecca. The reason is political, is social, we won't get into it. But what the Muslims do, and they do it more effectively than the Jews today, there is a strict forbiddance to study the Quran in any language save Arabic, which is perceived, not surprisingly, as God's vernacular. In Islam, the role and status of Arabic is equal to that of Hebrew in Judaism. But there is another reason for that. You have to understand that Judaism and Islam are two theological structures and religious responses who had emerged and evolved in the Mediterranean, in the Middle East. They are both Semitic in both origin and evolution, including linguistic evolution. Christianity is a theology and a religion that had evolved in Semitic origins, or was born out of Semitic origins, but evolved in pagan Europe, and needed to combat a completely different structure of linguistic requisites and theological beliefs. That's why Christianity, until this day, out of the three, is the one most seeped in pagan rituals, in symbolism, and iconography. They needed to correspond in the language and the cultural language of those with whom they came into contact. I'm not saying this to undermine Christianity. I'm just giving you the historical context here. Pagans.
So they were pagans. So what different types of pagans?
Well, first of all, before,
compared to the one that were in Europe. Since what I'm saying is
the paganism in Europe was much more evolved than the paganism in the Middle East.
What do you mean by evolved?
It had a much more complex pantheon, much more complex rituals. For example, the pagans who had inhabited Hijaz is what today is called Saudi Arabia, worshipped mainly three elements, all of which, these are Zarathustrians, these are different, three elements, all of which still exist in Islam: rocks, leaves of trees or trees, and water. In Islam, until today, before you pray, five times a day, before you pray, you have to wash your hands up to the elbow and wash your feet up to the knee. What does the Quran say, or better yet, the Hadith, say about a Muslim who doesn't have access to water and must pray? What can he wash his hands and feet with? Do you know? A leaf of a tree or a rock? Because these are remnants of pagan Hijaz, where those elements were perceived as holy. More than that, in the Muslim landscape, places that have a rock, a tree, and a spring are usually not called as haram, a sanctified landscape, which had affected Judaism profoundly. Do you think it's a coincidence that so many stories of rabbis in Judaism associate to some degree with a major rock or a cave, a major tree, and a major source of water? But more than that, it was a sanctified landscape. It was a sanctified landscape.
They were influenced by Islam or
of course,
or grew up in
An exchange of ideas. Look, guys, that's one of the first thing I told you. Anybody who tries to understand Judaism from a parochial standpoint as something that evolved in its own world is looking in vain. Judaism is the product of negotiations with many cultures. And so is every other theology. Islam had influenced Judaism profoundly. Judaism had influenced Islam profoundly. Both of which influenced Christianity less so because they had less of a contact. But no one can be understood without the other. And to be a scholar of Judaism or an informed Jew without having some sort of understanding of the other systems is a deficiency to some degree. It doesn't allow you to fully appreciate what Judaism had become. So guys, in summary, I hope that today and I urge you to read the essay in full because we'll give you all the data, we'll give you the bibliography. Once one understands Hebrew as a divinity cloaked in language, one can understand why Jews had revered Hebrew to a degree of a redemptive property. In rabbinic Judaism, you couldn't have been saved unless you were proficient in that language and able to manipulate, and I use manipulate here in the positive sense, God's word in a way that will ultimately lead you back to Eden, back to this ultimate knowledge. Talmud Torah, which for many of us is translated as merely an intellectual engagement with a text, for the rabbis was nothing less than an existential ordeal. Thank you, and we'll meet again next week.